the synagogue nowadays is not the most popular institution in the Jewish community. When I say the synagogue is not a popular institution in the Jewish community, I have in mind not the secular community or the agnostic community, which denies the transcendental origin of man, but the religious or semi-religious, or I may say the searching community. Of course, the agnostic communities need no synagogue. It can evade the synagogue and nevertheless enter the secularist, mundane Marxist lane. However, the religious or searching community, which logically should flock in droves to the synagogue, is not too much in love. I am in contact with this community. The activities and interests of this community, of the searching community, do not revolve about the synagogue. They stay away from the synagogue. There are a variety of reasons responsible for this paradoxical phenomenon. And we are just enumerating two or three, and many more. First, the unpopularity of the synagogue is the result of the anti-establishment mood of our times. You know what I mean. This rebellious frame of mind precipitated, sometimes in a frightening way, an upsurge of shallow, amorphous emotionalism, an upsurge which is detrimental to religious institutionalism and religious objectivism, or what shall I say, to religious reality. This is the main reason, of course. There is another reason. The commitment to the faith of Israel, which the diaspora Jews has accepted willingly, which is a miracle in itself, overshadows all our commitment to any local institution. The impact of that commitment upon the Western Jew, I don't think the assimilated Jew, the completely alienated Jew, but the Western Jew is still committed to Judaism, the impact of his commitment to the faith of Israel upon many whose lives were centered around the synagogue before the shift of concerns is tremendous. This is the second reason. The Jews, as far as charity is concerned, contributions, first priority in the state of Israel and its institution. And there is, and therefore there is a kind of an alienation on the part of the Western Jews from the synagogue. Third, and I want to be very frank with you, and I'm a rabbi, I'm not a successful rabbi, as far as congregational rabbinate is concerned, but still, I must admit that the rabbi, or we rabbis, are not without blame either. We have been perhaps too slow in evaluating the deep psychological changes that have occurred in the American Jewish community. The American Jew 20, 30 years ago, when I arrived to these shores, was ceremonial and protocol minded as far as the synagogue is concerned. He was almost a prisoner of rigid decorum and also inflexible social law. His personality as an American Jew 20, 30 years ago, and I knew the Jew very well, his personality was a two-dimensional, flat personality. However, he was very straight. He was very straight without twist, without bend, without curve. I'm not speaking about exceptions, I'm speaking about average type of American Jew. He was naive, like the American general. He was naive, in a certain respect, he's still naive. He was simple and open-minded, and he was stern, a stern personality. He liked the decorum of the synagogue, the solemnity, and the formality, and the dramatic character of the service. The young men of today, first of all, is a very complex person. There is no simplicity to the young men of today. With his critical approach, he is, and please pardon my expression now, is insolent, I would say chutzpah, and festive, feels alienated from a scrupulously well-organized worship. The young men of America today, if you are speaking about Jews, superficial emotion of the government. He would like to attend the service, which is more solemn and less deep, a volatile self. He would also like to see the synagogue become a house of study rather than just a house of prayer. The young Jew is curious and very sensitive. Somehow, I believe that we have a share in that practice of combination of the young religious Jew, and I'm speaking about agnostic, from the synagogue. The unpopularity of the synagogue within the American Jewish community, the young community, this community well, expresses itself in a variety of ways. First, young people, young couples do not care to join the neighborhood congregation. And I'm speaking about people who can afford to join the congregation. I'm not speaking about poor men. Like nomads, they wander from synagogue to synagogue, displaying impatience with all of them and liking none. Second, the religious observant Jew, young Jew in America, I don't know, perhaps New York is different, but my experiences are related to Boston. In Boston situation is like that. Yeah? I don't know.
Important and sits in judgment over mortal. I of a middle-aged and old monk. They never take into consideration the difficulties which the rabbi encounters in his quite often heroic effort to protect the traditional character of Israel. Is there a cure? Is there a way how to remedy this problem? I don't know. I have no solution to offer. However, I believe that a deeper understanding of the synagogue as an idea, not as an institution. The institution, to understand an institution is easy. But Jewish institutions, halachic institutions, are nurtured by ideas, by experience. Behind every institution, which is stable, fixed, standardized, and sometimes inflexible, there is a beautiful idea. There's a great vision. There's a great experience. No one has ever tried, since it's explained to people, not in this synagogue as an institution, but as an idea, as an experience, as a vision. Such, I would say, such an explanation might be helpful. We have seen in rabbis, in Balabashim, in other emphasizing the institutional character of the synagogue, while neglecting it to bring out the idea or the Weltanschauung which lies at the very root of the institution. We simply did not explain to people and to young people what Shiloh is and what Beit HaKnesset, the house dedicated to prayer, means, and how deeply rooted those ideas are in our philosophy of man and his day. Basically, Shiloh reflects the Judaic philosophy of man. Paradoxality. The exciting vision of man, and also the tragedy of man. Both his greatness and his merit are reflected in truth, in the idea of the disciples. And in my lecture tonight, this was just an introduction. In my lecture tonight, I shall attempt to explain the two ideas. Third idea, I'm very sympathetic and compassionate. I don't want to teach it too long. Which underlie prayer in general and the institution of Beit HaKnesset in particular. Let me start immediately with two postulates and say, postulate number one, man, I say not Jew, man is in exile. In exile. Or, if you want to change the phrase, man is a homeless being. Second, exiled man, a homeless man, must pray, perhaps he has a strong need to pray. Let me explain these two axioms. I do it what the philosophers of the 17th century used to say, more at your measure,
the way mathematics, mathematicians.
When we say the word galut or exile, we right away, by mere association, think of the Jews. Exile as an historical experience is known only to the Jews. No other nation has ever led an exilic existence, an existence in exile. By this statement, I do not mean to say that there were no population shifts in the general history, that no other people has ever been displaced from its native soil. The opposite is true. History is full of stories about the movement of entire populations, or what is called Völkerwanderung. Yet the movement of populations from one country to another did not result in an exile experience in the manner in which we Jews have experienced. It is self-evident with regard to immigration that the first generation of immigrants or exiles suffers for a while from a sense of alienation and estrangement. The immigrants feel particularly in a case in which the emigration was not voluntary but coercive, they feel homeless and displaced for a while. True. However, with the passage of time, the nostalgia subsides on the part of the immigrants. Everyone who came from across would confirm my experience. The nostalgia subsides, the emotional alienation disappears gradually, the community, the commitment to the old country witness piecemeal images, scenes, memories are little by little extinguished. And with their extinction, the experience of exile disappears. As a rule, for there is an exception. The second and third generation knows nothing of the old country. Of the bond between their parents or grandparents and their native soil belongs. Home is the new country. The old one sinks into oblivion, completely forgotten. The Jew behaves differently. He somehow, it's very hard to guess how he managed to do it, managed to preserve his historical identity as a people, and he was also successful in maintaining a very strong sentimental relationship to a land from which he was exiled 1900 years ago. That we have maintained such a relationship, or I would rather say a commitment. We know what comparison is, what is the best proof? The state of Israel. Without that strange commitment, 1900 year commitment to a land on which you were exiled, the state of Israel would have never come into existence. The Jew somehow has beheld and still beholds a messianic vision. He has waited, and he is still waiting the arrival of the Redeemer, and the triumphant return to Abraham's land. The promise the Jew has never forgotten. The Jew in the Middle Ages, in the dark and narrow ghettos, the Jew of the Renaissance period, the Jew of the Reformation era, and of the Age of Reason, the Jew of the Catholic society of modern times, and the Jew of communist society. The contemporary Jew of communist society, whose parents were agnostic ladies, whose grandparents fought with Lenin and Trotsky and Bukharov for socialism and the Marxist millennium. The Jew, in all those periods in Europe, couldn't forget the promise. And has turned his face for 1900 years while praying to our dead mysterious country, land he never visited, never saw, whose climate was alien to him, and whose wrath radiated and oppressed him, which the Nordic Jew can't tolerate. And in spite of everything, he somehow maintained the commitment. He never forgot his strange land. He longed and craved for it. Very funny. The Jew, who is a real soldier, clutched a very pragmatical in my head, spoke like a dreamer, whenever the name of death runs, mysterious, unknown it was mentioned. He romanticized her, and surrounded her with almost a transcendental halo. And that's why the Jew lived in exile. Yes, as in exile, he prayed, his whole existence cried out at the Jew. It's very interesting. If you analyze this in essay, 6 out of the 18 or 19 Benedictines are concerned with one burning passion, with one strong desire, intoxicating desire, to terminate exile. However, Johannes said that not only the Jew is in exile, but many such, many gentlemen, lead an exilic existence. Of course, if we speak of exile in historical terms, then the Jewish experience is unique. However, if we approach the idea of exile, the idea of galut, from a metaphysical existential viewpoint, then the Jewish galut experience is universal. Moreover, our exile or exile experience is just a reflection of the universal metaphysical exile awareness with which man, not only the Jew, many generals, like the least of the better, who was burdened the very instant he was cursed by the Almighty and expelled from the path. Why? What is man? That is the main problem now. Philosophy until the Second World War They start asking, what is the world? What is the universe? What's the other? Until, let's say, the 20s, was concerned with Newton physics and with relativity and with problems of causality. Space, time, quantity, quality. Philosophical categories, objective philosophical categories. But philosophy in the 20s, particularly philosophy after the Second World War, rejected decided that instead of asking what space is, one should ask the old Socratic question, who am I? And now is what you call existentialism in all this. A lot of it. What you call existentialism is nothing else but an attempt on part of man to understand himself, to understand his fellow man, and simply to understand his destiny. Simply to inject a little bit of rationality in our own existence. Because our own existence, quite often, is very absurd, ridiculous, and tragic as well. The modern philosophy asks, who is man? What is man? The Bible answers, you know what man is? Man is an exile. Human existence is an exilic existence. Gay, and this was revealed, you know, by whom? Who would you say was revealed? Who are you? My mother. You're the lady. Who? Avron, perhaps, but certainly David, gay related woman. Patient colonizer. I'm a stranger, I'm a sojourner, I'm a traveler, a lonely traveler. I am a homeless being, I'm in exile, even though patient colonizer, I have lived so many years and this world. Man is homeless because he was expelled from his paradisical home. And he, like the historical Jew with regard to the promised land, has never forgotten, man has never forgotten, that once upon a time, so many millennia ago, he lived in the paradise. Of course he was. Man's home has been and still is the paradise upon which God showers so much beauty and grace. Outside of the paradise, man finds himself lost in the vast spaces and boundless distances of an unknown, strange, and frightening world full of disease, hunger, and poverty and human suffering. Men feel... Now, there is something else to be mentioned. He has a suit of a man from a dialectical view. In general, dialectics is basically yes. And I said so many times, Judaism never believed in Aristotelian, but also partially, that if A is either A or B, A cannot be at the same time. One cannot be at the same time, A and B. One is either A or is B. It cannot be at the same time, A and B. You haven't never agreed with it. I mean, if you, I could prove it analogically, but not in place, but I can't for that. We have a certain knowledge matter. One can be A and B at the same time. The thesis is correct, and the antithesis is also correct. Whoever has an inkling of philosophy knows of Heraclitus, in ancient times, in Hegel, in almost modern times, they spoke about the contradiction between the thesis and antithesis. It was a problem. How can you hate Sulim and Christian were there? How can you say that both are right? You have to never walk away. You have to say the thesis is correct and the antithesis is also correct. It's a paradox, but it's true. And with regard to man, you have to consider man both, great and small. Many nations and many devils. Hence, if man is homeless, he is homeless in a direct manner. As man in his greatness, man experiences his homelessness. In his wondrous rise to the star, he experiences his homelessness. Now, while you are listening to my lecture, there is a gate who sent up to the moon. And he's great, he's a genius. But in his greatness, in his experience, his own greatness, he feels his homelessness. And also man feels his homelessness in his experience, his smallness. In his pitiful fall into Namaki, the bottomless pit. In a word, there is man is homeless as small being, little being, a fallen being. Man is also homeless as a great being, as a rising being. What kind of homelessness experience is interwoven in man's awareness of himself as a great being, in his pride? Man is very proud and at times very despondent. At times man is very, has self-confidence, at times he's very dejected. It's not just psychological move upon the other. It's not just a move, it's more than that. There is a clash of experiences in man. What is the homelessness which man experiences when he thinks of himself as a great being, as a proud being, as a genius, as a senator? How does he experience his homelessness? Then the question is, how does man experience his homelessness when he thinks of himself as a little being, as a small being? When he's dejected and despondent, how does he explain? Let us explain it. Man experiences his homelessness as a small being, as a little being, in the fact that he is vulnerable. Vulnerable and exposed to all the vicissitudes of an effect, an unconcerned, an indifferent environment. The best thing you can say about nature, as far as many concerned, that it is indifferent and unconcerned. You know that very well from your practical experience. This feeling of being vulnerable, of being exposed, is the feeling of homelessness. Man is an exposed being, of course. He's exposed to disease, he's exposed to death. Of course, the beast is also exposed. The brute, the beast in the field, is also exposed. Also vulnerable, yes. However, the beast is not homeless. Not even a stray dog is a homeless dog. Because The beast knows nothing and does not anticipate. Man is aware of himself and his environment and anticipates events, because man has an awareness of time and he looks forward to the future. How can man speak at a home which is supposed to provide man with shelter and security, if he knows well that he's not a security? Because he doesn't know what will happen the next moment. I mean, the whole, I said it many times tonight, in my addresses, the whole American philosophy, this is not the current philosophy now, America has changed, but when I came to the United States, the ideal for the young man, the ideal for the adult, in choosing a career, deciding about a profession, was security. If you speak about secure financial security, perhaps there is a possibility. But man is not just a financial being, not only concerned with money, he's also concerned with his health, body, with his children, his happiness of his wife. To speak of security in a total sense with regard to human life is simply the act. So how can man be home? How can man think of a home if the home fails to provide him this security, if shelter has been denied to man? There's a very strange passage in Shira Shirim. We read in the Mitzvah of Shoyne, Shishim Giberim Shalim Wa Megiberi Yisroel, Kulam Achuz Echer, Mulam Dei No Kobo, Ich Farbe Ali Reche, Mipachar Kamedes. Strange passage. What kind of story? Behold, it is the leader of the dead of Solomon. Please saw of mighty men, of the mighty men of Israel. They all have the sword and are excelled in war. Every man has his sword upon his thigh because of the dread in the night. I remember as a little boy, I was studying with my rabbi, not the one human. I asked him, what is the dread in the night? What is the Tachan Barayas? You know what I have answered? I've already said it. He said, don't ask me a question. All right, but the question still bothered my mind, my young man, my sister, who was a little boy. And I came home. I was a boy of 7, I remember. It was not very pedagogical to teach. I should have heard that answer. All right. This is pardon, forgive. And I came home and I asked my mother, what is it, Tachan Barayas? What does it mean, the dread? My mother didn't answer. And so he told me, reach my heart and go to bed. When she tucked me in there, I forgot the dread in the night. But what is the dread in the night? What is it? What is this dread in the darkness? Who is afraid? Who takes so many security measures in order to protect himself against the dread in the night? Who is it? Who is it? Shirashiram revealed already who he is, his identity. King Solomon is afraid. King Solomon is afraid of the dread at night, by the night. And King Solomon has no mother to tuck him in. And he's afraid.
is actually impressive.
Who is King Solomon?
Who is King Solomon? Modern man, wise man, powerful, ingenious, an expert in all fields of science, and a technological wizard who sends off a man's babe to the moon, whose computations are almost flawless. He, King Solomon, is a man. Mitachat Alelis, as the great engineer, King Solomon is powerful. What is he afraid about? His men are indeed mighty. Mighty men, experts in the war. Yes, everything is true. But nevertheless, he is afraid. This does not make him. All the mighty men do not make King Solomon secure and safe. He is as insecure, King Solomon, with his mighty warriors, is as insecure as the poor shepherd in the Galilean hills. And the Pachatolenes has not been defeated. In his day. Yes, man can send the vehicle to the moon. But what does the wise, mighty, sophisticated, technologically minded King Solomon do if he comes face to face with one little small malignant cell? If you, I mean, I assume, I mean, members of the you say your prayers every morning. The Jewish morning prayers reflect something very peculiar. At least, as far as I know, they reflect the morning prayers of the kind of Shemesh Sadhguru. Baruch Atah Hashem, Baruch Atah Hashem, Baruch Atah Hashem, Baruch Atah Hashem, reflect a happy mind, a rejoicing heart, a happily surprised person. There is an element of surprise which you detect in between the lines of the first pages in every prayer book. Somehow, a surprised person who somehow achieves the unexpected. There is a note of excitement and wonder in the morning liturgy. The Jewish night, Hanukkah Shalom. Thank God, grateful for that. Why? Because it feels as if he feels overwhelmed with the fact that he is fully aware and did rise from his slumber. Because there was a possibility, another possibility, the night before. He was almost skeptical about it. And a few before retirement, it was introduced as a broche into the evening service. Baruch Hashem, what is the central verse in Baruch Hashem, Leilam Amin V'Amin? There is one central verse. V'yotcho af t'drushi. I entrust my spirit, myself. Whether you found this or not, I don't know. I entrust it. He said it every Jew. Every Jew says it. But what he's saying is not too sure that God will help to his surrender of his prayer. Even though he recited last night before retiring, beyond half the he was not sure that the great chesed would bestow upon him.
and will be, and he indeed will rise from his slumber. He recites now in the morning enthusiastically, Malachi, the Shomash, the Samadhi, and David, a new gift, it's a new present, it's a new life. And there is to those benedictions a daring and sincere surprise. Somehow, when the Jew gets up in the morning and says his prayers, there is an accelerated heartbeat accompanies those prayers. This is the homelessness of man as a small being, as a little being. It comes to expression in his feeling of insecurity and fright. Human beings are frightened. I'll tell you, as a young man, the fright is not pronounced. It is hidden under our, let's say, trust in our parents, in ourselves. But as man advances in age, and gets older, so he's a frightened person. I've never seen an old man, and I know it myself, who is not frightened. Some people know how to manage their fright. Some people know how to sublimate their fright into creativity. Some people don't know. And the whole, the American Jew does not know how to handle old age. He doesn't know. He cannot sublimate old age in wisdom, in dignity, in creative efforts. He doesn't know the secret of sublimation. And the old man, mother old man, so who lives in luxury, and who travels around the globe 5 times a year, doesn't know how to defeat the fright. And paradise makes man homeless. Now let us pick up the second experience of man. Man experiences himself as a great being, a powerful being, an exalted man, King Solomon, or King Johannes, who has risen high and above his fellow man, finds his homelessness expressed not in insecurity, but in a certain restlessness, in questing for the boundless, for the unachievable. Great man is homeless because he's never satisfied with his own great gesture. He's always driven by both satanic, unsatiable urge to conquer and to control beyond and above the bounds which God has assigned him. And he's also driven by divine urge, by noble aspirations and exalted visions. No matter what the ultimate end is, the human being is not happy with his modest home, with the status quo. He journeys in the path unknown. And of course, he is always disenchanted. The human creative fantasy knows no bounds. The whole phenomenon we call civilization is an expression of human homelessness and human restlessness. As a matter of fact, Chabad, this doctrine of human restlessness, is central in Chabad philosophy.
the way I understand Chabad.
You see, the philosophy man is restless. What is restless for? What is he looking for? For a home.
Where is man's home?
Where? In the paradise.
Where is the paradise?
The paradise is in God. Man's restlessness is man's questing for God. Sometimes knowingly, consciously, intentionally, and sometimes unconsciously, unintentionally. Man moves away from God while searching.
Now, let us come. Homeless man was commanded to pray. Batal chol tzucho kol hadvorim ha'ile. In thy distress. What distress is in your homelessness. And all those things are come upon thee. Thou wilt return to the Lord thy God. Be more exact, homeless man feels a desire for prayer. For a final analysis, as I said just a while ago about Chabad, what is man questing for? What is man looking for? What is he searching? He searches for another way, for another field, for another $1 million, for another luxury. No, he's searching. He's misled. He's mistaken. He's searching for the revenge for us. And how can you find the revenge for us? How can men find God? Only through prayer. So means homeless man, he misled for a home. He's questing for God. Within 50-mile radius from the town campus college. And you cannot imagine, I mean, the primitive conditions and the circumstances under which the Russian peasant lived, shall I say, 50 or 55 years ago. And I remember Friday late afternoon, I used to come to school early, and I used to watch the people coming in one by one, with water rinsing from their face and beards, because they were immersed in the mikveh. And immediately, beginning to rub their hands. Heidu al-shem kiteitum chadayim wa yogu ve'ad Hashem, asha gorom yatsor, ta'ot iskitzom, mimizrach u'mimayrach u'mitafriyon. A sound the hymn of gratitude to God for what? For delivery from captivity. For freeing people from the prison. For freedom every time. You found the people, I mean, clean to God, and they came home. In spite of the fact we knew very well that next day, 72 minutes after our sunset, they'll return to the peasants, to the ignorant primitive peasants in the villages surrounding the village. And this is exactly the idea of prayer. Prayer of Yochim, which lies at the institution of prayer and synagogue, to come home, to defeat the fright, the dread by them in the night, and finally to return home. As a matter of fact, you ask me, why not pray in the field, in the woods, in the street? God is ubiquitous. God is omnipresent everywhere. Why does the halacha require a house consecrated to prayer? I want you to understand, even a yochid, an individual, should try to say his prayers in the synagogue. Why? Why is it necessary? It's not because the synagogue has a symbolic meaning. It's not the material structure which is important. It's not so much the roof, and not so much the big galleries, and the high windows. It is not important. You know, we have never cared about architecture of the synagogue. They speak a lot now, but we didn't care. The halacha is completely unconcerned with architecture. What is important is the word bayit in Hebrew has a double connotation. Bayit in Hebrew means a house, physical structure, four walls, a roof and a floor. I mean, and bayit in Hebrew means a home. And we are making a mistake in translating Beisa Knesset, the house of prayer. It's not true. There is no need for a house of prayer, because I can pray to God, I can meet Him, I can comfort, I can have a rendezvous with Him in any spot, not only on the globe, in the universe. Even on the outskirts of the universe I can pray. I am confronted with God, but it's the home of prayer. The structure is symbolic. Beit HaKnesset is an idea, namely the home of man, of homeless man. This home is found through prayer by men coming back to his to God, who is the real, the genuine home, main of the king. As a matter of fact, I asked Rabbi thing to give me Tanakh Melachim. I wanted, if I had more time, to analyze Tfilah Shleimei, the famous prayer by Solomon, and the dedication exercises of the temple, and to show you that exactly what Solomon answers. Because Solomon asked the question, Ki Aomnom, Ki Aomnom Yeshev Likim Al Ores, Ine Hashamayim Ushvei Hashamayim Leichalkulucho, Ach Ki Abayis Hazeh Hashabonisi. But will God, in very truth, dwell on the earth? Behold, heaven and heaven of heavens cannot contain thee. How much less the house that I have built? And what is the answer to this question? Not God is homeless, man is homeless. When God said, we also will meet us as a ham to the Sechon, he did not need a home for himself. He feigned homelessness in order to induce man to build a home for himself. And whatever name you, whatever you call the home, Beis HaMikdash, Beis HaKnesses, it is not the home of God. It is the home of God, because it is the home of God. And that's exactly what King Solomon enters in a long treatise on feeling. And you take, for instance, you just count the interruption for who is homeless? Solomon mentions them one by one. Eis ha-shayach to Yisrael. Two people call, two friends part from each other. Two friends turn into enemies. So the friend, I mean the two people who lost friendship, the most precious gift in the world, and meant friendship for the individual. Sandra had a friend, he confided to me, I confided to him. But due to certain reasons, sometimes completely unreasonable, we started to fight. Friendship was terminated in skin enemies. They are both homeless men. If you lose a friend, you are a homeless being. This homeless being who bore Elif Nimitz Bechachot Abayis Azeh, let him come to Jerusalem, to the home of prayer, because he lost a home. He must find a home, which he should substitute for the home he lost. Be no give up for Israel with Meir. My people will be defeated by the fiend, by the enemy. And you'll be exiled. Homeless people, Vashi. Geheidu lecho, vizchanu lecho babay sazeh. They'll come back. They'll find their home. Where? In the home of prayer. Do'otzei resa shumayim v'nimoto. Famine. Rob ki yivor et shidofe yirokim. Disease. Man is exposed. Man is vulnerable. Man is homeless. He is terrorized by the fright in the night. He needs a home. Should give him security. At least a sense of security. Should give him shelter. For a scuffle of alibis, he'll spread out his hands and he'll travel toward the home of prayer. That's exactly the idea of Beis HaKnesses. Beis HaKnesses is the home of God because it's the home of prayer. Now, if you are when you want to listen, all right, I want to develop a second idea of these classes. There is a very strange
פסק משבת. מסכת שבת, פרקטים צבת. את הערב אצלם מדליקים, I don't remember the page. תורי רבי שמואל בן אלעזר אומר, רבי שמואל בסן את אלעזר, said, בעבין שני דבורים עמי אורץ מייסי. There are two reasons why ignorant people don't live long. Their lifespan is short. Als bekehrim loren akedesh arne, because we call the Oren HaKedesh the Holy Ark, Armor. Armor is Hermetic Aphoric. The Owl, Shekirin Beis HaKnesses Beis Abed Am. And also because they call Abed HaKnesses Abed Am. The nature of the first violation after meeting the word HaKedesh from the phrase Aren HaKedesh concerning the art, we understand. We understand why it's wrong. By referring to the sacred art which contains the law as armor, one equates the former with an ordinary closet or box. This sacralizing the Torah which is kept there. That's why it is sacrilegious and hence sanctioned. That I understand. However, the nature of the second scene is substituting the word Bet-Am for better blessed is prima facie not obvious, not too clear. What does better blessed mean in plain English and analysis? What do you think? How is that assembled? On the other hand, let us ask, what is the literal meaning of Bet-Am? Again, the house of the people, the house of the multitude. What is semantically the difference between Beit HaKnesses and Beit HaKnesses? Very strange. And the Gemara considered it a very serious offense. If you simply take into consideration what kind of punishment it was that associated with this offense. The answer to this problem, I ask you to pay attention here. A little difficult, a little bumpy. The answer to this problem, in my opinion, lies in an halachic institution. Namely, the institution of Shlichut. Shlichut, Shin Lamed Yud Ches Vav Sof. Yes, correct. At first glance, we have in Rambam a section dealing with shluchim and shutim, with partnerships and praxis. You have shluchim and shluchim, you have gemaras about it, many sugyas which deal with shluchim, with praxis. At first glance, we are inclined to look upon this institution, namely the institution of shluchim, as if it were rooted exclusively in legalistic formalism, not containing anything transcending the civil juridic utility of that particular institution. As a matter of fact, Shluchus, as a formal institution, as a legalistic, civil institution, is known not only to us, but to the civilizing world. As such, Roman law, English common law, know very well are familiar with the institution of praxis. What does the institution say? In plain legal terms,
that one can transfer authority or bestow authority upon another individual to act on his behalf as his deputy or agent. Because it's a necessity nowadays. The more complex communication between people became, the more the distances separating people from each other extended, the more pressing became the need for action by proxy or deputy. However, when we study the laws of Shlichus carefully, analytically, we arrive at a different conclusion. That Shlichus is not just a formal institution, a utilitarian institution. Simply, I give authority to my neighbor to sign an agreement or to finalize a transaction of my behalf. In Judaism, Shlichus represents something else. Judaism has formulated Shlichus in a very unique way. The idea is not just, belongs not only into the juridic, formalistic realm, but it has a personalistic note. This personalistic note in Shlichut sometimes reaches out for the metaphysical. And I'll explain to you. Shlichut in Yahadus consists not only in the bestowing of authority by A upon B, to act for him in absentia. But also in the personalistic identification of A with B. Or unlike the agent in common law, the shliach in Judaic law acts not for the shliach. And instead, but together with him, or to be more precise, the shliach is the alter ego, but not the way literally understood. Not the way understood, I mean, in colloquial, literally understood. The alter ego, indeed, the shliach actually undergoes, what shall I say, a miraculous metamorphosis and turns into the mishaleach. Yet the part of the latter impersonates, like the artist and the theatrical stage. We have one distinction. You know the distinction. That while the artist, the actor, impersonates a certain figure, a certain hero in the drama, just artist in an artistic fictional manner, the shliach, according to Yahadus, impersonates the mishaleach in an existential, personalistic way. The phrase itself, Shluch HaShalom Kameseh, what does it mean in English? The Mashiach assumes the identity of the Mishaleach. There is a personal union of Shliach and Mishaleach. Because in Yahadus, Shlichus is rooted in an ethical moral experience. It is rooted in the idea of Chesed.
Let us ask, what ends at the very instant is clear and appointed? What transpires when A tells B? It's a very strange formula, I tell you. He doesn't say yes or have a shoot. He has a bit. He tells me, Yodim, my heaven is like thy heaven. Thy heaven is like mine. Mine. Pichok it be, your mouth, your lips, is like mine. The Bumach Kiribur, your words, are to be considered like my words. Something great, exciting happens. What happens? The barriers fencing in an egocentric man existence are torn down. And a lonely cat who had until now no friend, a narcissist addicted to that vainglory and self-love, breaks out into the three open spaces of existing in fellowship, of being together. The very moment I don't perform any shiras on behalf of anybody, says, I am myself, I am just isolated. My existence is sensed in. It is egocentric. It's sometimes very selfish. But the very moment I take upon myself to perform a mission for my next door neighbor, so what happens? I begin to share in his problems. I unite with him. I actually, there is a merger of interests, of cares, of concerns, of hopes, and aspirations. It's a new kind of friendship which he had to establish between the Shliach and the Shliach. The Shliach, in order to play, quotation marks, the part of the Mishaleach must get acquainted with the Mishaleach. With the latter scares and anxieties. He must share in his distress and rejoice with him in times of triumph. Not even an actor on the stage can play the part of a certain figure if he does not understand. He's acting in such a case with his teeth, mechanical, lifeless. How could the Shliach impersonate the Mishaleach, play the part at an existential, personalistic level? If the bond of sympathy, of kindness, concern, and curiosity does not play. The egotist, the egotist, the self-loving person who does not acknowledge the presence of others in this world can hardly assume the identity of his next door neighbor. How could he? He doesn't exist for him. He's basically shlichus. He's an empty performance, to be honest. And that's why you understand the certain aloha, which is completely incomprehensible. Ma'akel b'nei bris, ashluchachem b'nei bris. The Shliach must be like the Meshaleach, a ben bris, a member of the covenant, means a Jew. Because there are peace separating members of the covenantal society from those who profess another faith, must not separate the Shliach from the Meshaleach. If existential, if destiny is different, if historical memories are not the same, if misunderstanding prevails, if full sympathy and mutual concern are in improbability, then shlichus cannot be achieved. For the latter requires the sharing in the destiny, the drawing on similar historical memories and understanding which results in compassion. In where he has his nurture by present, merger of personal experiences and mutual sharing in distress and in joy. This is this. And that is the reason for a very strange halacha, that Shlichus is valid not only in civil transactions, but also in personal, private relationship between man and God. I don't know whether you guess what I have in mind. The source of Shlichus, the foundation of Shlichus, where is it? What is the prototype of Shlichus? What is the prototype of Shlichus? Klali Korbanos. Shlichus and Korbanos. There is a rule that Ein Korbanos a lot of Kohen Elokei Ein Midal Gavah. No sacrifice must be offered in the absence of the Baal HaKorban, or the person who has pledged the sacrifice. However, the same rule says there is no need for the Baal HaKorban, for the owner of the sacrifice, to be presently incorporated at the sacrificial offering. The presence of a shliach appointed by the Baal HaKorban suffices. As a matter of fact, the whole Shlichus doctrine is the foundation upon which the whole institution rests. It is self-evident that the Shliach who represents the Baal HaKorban or the owner at the sacrificial ceremony in the sanctuary in the Hazora is not just a formal agent. Formal agent is good to sign an agreement or to sell share, stop it. But to represent the Mishaliah with Leah Hashem in the house of God, the offering. The presence of a Shliach appointed by the Baal HaKorban suffices. As a matter of fact, the whole Shlichus doctrine is the foundation upon which the whole institution rests. It is self-evident that the Shliach who represents the Baal HaKorban or the owner at the sacrificial ceremony in the sanctuary in the Hazora is not just a formal agent. A formal agent is good to sign an agreement or to sell shares, stop it. But to represent the Mishaliah with Leah Hashem in the house of God, while the sacrifice of the Mishaliah is over, a formal agency, a formal proxy is not enough. It would be sacrilegious to say that just a proxy, which may be able to sell stock on behalf of the sender, suffices to represent the Baal HaKorban in the Beis HaMikdash, in the Azore. The Shliach apparently takes on the identity of the Baal HaKorban and acts the latter star existentially. Of course, this kind of Shlichus is not just a personalistic performance, it's a metaphysical one. And now let me say, the prophet in the Bible is the messenger of God. God is the Mishaliach, the prophet is the Shlichus. Prophets are called Malachim in the Bible. Vayishlach Malach, Vayitzayim v'Mitzrayim. And Malach means Moses. However, God does not just send off the prophet It is a message. He leaves not the traffic alone. He moves along with the traffic. And everything speaks through him. You know, the famous expression, Kino mit der Peres, mit der Grenisch Omeche. God spoke out of the mouth or throat of Moses. The voice of the Shina came out of the throat of Moses. And interesting is another passage in the Bible. When Moses complained, who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt? God answered him in three cryptical words. Ki eye imocha. Because I'll be with thee. But can I ask? Maybe said, I'm not qualified for that. I'm not worthy of the mission. So what kind of an answer is Eliyah? In other words, God told Moses, listen, Moses, the shlichus which I am entrusting to thee is unique. You're not a prax. You're not an agent. You're not a deputy. The Mishaleah will not absent himself from this shliach. He will walk along with the shliach silently and whisper, of course, not to be overheard by others, into the ear of the shliach what he's supposed to do and how to act. This kind of shliachus that I told you before extends beyond the ethical personalistic boundaries into the realm of the metaphysical, indeed mystical experience of man joining God and sharing in his infinite essence. As man's voice is the echo of God's voice, man reflects the image of the Shliach, reflects the image of the Mishaleach. The whole institution at Tfilah B'Tzibur and the synagogue, which is dedicated to Tfilah B'Tzibur, rests upon the idea of Shlichus, the way I explain it. What is Tzibur, if you ask me? What is Tzibur? Tfilah B'Tzibur also. Of course, in the vernacular, Hebrew, English, Yiddish, Latin, in all the vernacular, also in Russian, we identify tzibur with the meaning. Correct? You don't say tzibur. Tzibur is in the, what shall I say, the lingo of the scholar. The plain lingo, in the colloquial, it is meaning. What is meaning? 10 Jews together. The number 10. I beg your pardon? 8 by 8? Huh? 8 of correct. Half, if you ask me, is this, what shall I say, is an equation of Tzibur with Minyan correct? Is it correct? I'll tell you. Technically, it's correct. Philosophically, not even philosophically, halachically. It's only correct technique. Because in order to understand the word tzibur, we have to simply to take up the problem of core tzibur. What is the connotation of tzibur as regards kabbalists? It's important. After all, we all know that Korbanes, Tfilas, became Korbanes. As prayer, or the three institutional prayers, morning, afternoon, and evening, how does the covering of the sacrifices offered by the people in antiquity? What is the semantic semantics of the term tibor concerning minimum suffering, concerning common tibor? Of course, as Rabbi Luxner remarked, tibor with regard to common is to be equated with Adon, with Adas Israel. Not an Indian. In other words, tibor vis-a-vis common signifies the entire Jewish community, or let me say, the whole covenantal community. The Jewish community is the covenantal community. If 10 people should get together and bring jointly a sacrifice, you all know that the latter would not be considered as common tibur, but as korban hashishim. No one would treat the sacrifice offered by 10 people as a korban tibur, since the current tibur, halachically, is related to the entirety of the Jewish. Hence, the term tibur, or tfilah tibur, is regarding to tfilah, is to be understood as referring not to them. But to the Klal Yisrael, or rather, the Knesset Yisrael. God hearkens to prayer of the community as a whole, to prayer offered by the Adas Israel in its entirety. No one must be excluded. The Nislach Lechol Adas Israel. The Nikdash Israel Bnei Israel. Only within all the people, in the midst of the entire community, will I be sanctified. And Allah derives from this verse the famous conclusion, as in Dovah Shebikdusho, Poches Me'asorek, one is not allowed to reside in a world of sanctification if 10 people are not present. The question is obvious. On the one hand, the Bible states, Besoch Bnei Israel, only in the midst of all the people I shall be sanctified and glorified, not in the presence of just a part of the people. On the other hand, however, the Halacha sanctions the recital of Kedusha in the presence of 10 old men. How can we square, how can we reconcile the verse in the Bible? The Nikdash is the same in Israel, Kedusha must be recited in the presence of the entire, of the whole community, to the exclusion of no one. And it is our daily practice that we are satisfied with 10 people. You know what the answer lies. It is self-evident that the halacha in permitting 10 people to recite Kedusha, to say Omer Yishvei Rabo, to El Sadoruch Hadishem Amir of Lelo Moed, operated with the idea of Shlichus, not proxy Shlichus. The 10 are the representatives of the Klal Yisrael. They are the shluchim of the people as a whole. And the way we have explained shlichus before, just a while ago, they are not only representatives, They're not only ambassadors of the cloudy soil. They are the cloudy soil. They, in a mystical way, in a strange, paradoxical way, they interpret, not fictionally, not artistically, but existentially, metaphysically, mystically, the cloudy soil within themselves. In other words, when 10 people in the synagogue offer their prayers, the entire Knesset Israel prays with them. They are the Knesset Israel. And let me, that's why Kedusha has been permitted in the presence of them. Because the 10 impersonate all Israel. They assume the identity. They have the heart of the entire Knesset Israel. This is not analytic theology. These are logically correct. Let me add another thought. When we pronounce the term Knesset Israel, it's the most beautiful term. There are many, the Hadas Israel, Bnei Israel, Am Israel. The most beautiful term is Knesset Israel. We refer not only to a crowd consisting of 13 million people, contemporaries, came here. Before the Second World War, we were 18 million people. 6 million were exterminated by Hitler in Auschwitz. We are now 13 million people, perhaps. A little more, I don't know. The latest statistics I haven't read. Knesset Israel, the way Nachmanides, the Rambam, and other mystics, the classical Balei HaKabbalah, understood the term, is not just a conglomeration of people. It's not just a crowd. It is not just a herd. It is not just a multitude. It is more than that. It is a separate entity, a living individuality, provided with an eye awareness. They spoke about the invisible Knesset Israel. There is a visible Knesset Israel, which consists of contemporaries, of 13 million people now. Now, there is an invisible Knesset Israel, which embraces not only contemporaries living in the year 1973, but every Jew who has ever lived and died with the exclamation of Shema Yisrael on his lips. All those whose names it includes, it embraces, all those whose names have been immortalized and made unforgettable by the Sefer HaSforim and by the Bible, as well as all those Jews who lived in anonymity, died silently, and were buried in an unmarked grave, without leaving a single memory, without leaving a single footprint on the shifting sand of human destiny. All of them, great or small, big or little, are part and parcel of the invisible Knesset Israel, which is represented, and to be more exact, impersonated by the minion of 10 old, frail, sickly people. Furthermore, Knesset Israel holds in her embrace every Jew who will ever live on the face of our globe. Generations yet unborn, people unknown, unreal, enveloped by the fog of vanity existence, those some point in the dark, awesome future, to render a great service to our people, as well as those whose contributions will equal zero. Great people, small people, colorful people, dull people, all of them belong to the invisible presence of Israel, represented by the 10 people who on a rainy afternoon get a shoe and say, Asher Yishev Yisechor, who are the Yishev Yisechor? The entire class of Israel, from Abraham to the King Messiah. Fundamentally, there is only one prayer. Fundamentally, there is only one tzibur, the invisible Knesset Israel, embracing past, present, future. And that invisible Knesset Israel prays with every minyan. The tzibur in the synagogue is the micro Knesset Israel of 10, which represents, personifies, the macro community of the invisible classes, the eternal community of such. Let me say that the idea of Yichus Yir reaches, as it is the case with prophecy, into the mystical, the invisible, eternal classes, cutting through all ages, male or male, is present in every concrete micro-community of 10, the macro-community, the invisible, even if Knesset Yisrael contracts itself. We need a tzimtzum in order to find room in a small, finite community of 10. I've asked before, why is the halacha so meticulous regarding the name of the Knesset? What's wrong with this Bet Am? Why did our sages say that it is a serious offense to substitute Bet Am for Bet Knesset? The answer is simple now. The Knesset is the home of the great invisible Knesset Israel, which cut through all ages, ages, and centuries and millennia. So the Dam is just a house for contemporaries, in together. So to pray, it's not enough one joins just the Am, the people of Israel. But never. One must pray with the entire covenantal community, which is present in the Pesach Knesset. And the Kedusha of Pesach Knesset is due to that mysterium tremendum. The ladder suspends all three times dimensions. The past is not gone yet. The future has already arrived. And we, the 10 people, the million who live in the present, unite both past and future. We are the bridge. Abraham shakes hands with this King Messiah. The great future meets the glorious past, which has anxiously waited for that opportunity. The place of Knesset, the home of prayer, as I said before, is the home of the Knesset Israel for those who already lived, played a part, and disappeared in anonymity, for those who haven't had a chance to play the part on the eternal historical stage of Yahavis. We have asked what happens when 10 people get together and begin to recite Asher. What event takes place? Why are you so excited about this project? We kept on inquiring. Why are you excited? Because the meeting of the millennium, gracious Zachary, stretched out their hands
across the abyss of time and greet each other. And between racial darkness, we are ready to say our prayers. In conclusion, I want to say a few words. And I'm pleased. Don't misconstrue the meaning of the word. I'm not given to flattery. I've never engaged in panegyric. I have a liking for pioneers, for experimenters, for people who don't follow the crowd. I always admire the first ones, the early ones, the beginners. Even my brush, I prefer to speak about Abraham, about Joseph, about Moses, because of their own pioneers. Those biblical figures who defied public opinion, disregarded mockery and ridicule, and blazed new trails in the historical jungles of pagan antiquity. My presence here tonight and delivery of the address is about close to 2 hours. It's not long for me, but it's long for you. And I want to tell you, I'm a very difficult fellow to get to deliver a long address. I get many invitations, I know, mostly. I get many invitations, I reject all of them. I've accepted the invitation immediately. I did not tell, I'll call him Haskin, Rabbi Buchstein, he's my Talmud, I called him his first name. I didn't tell Haskin, come back, I'll think about it, I'll consult my calendar. I said, you want me? I'll be back. My presence here tonight is only due to my profound respect and friendship, sincere friendship, for your rabbi, illustrious rabbi, Rabbi Joseph Buchstein. Shall I mention you too? For you, for your power, I feel both friendship and respect. For you, I feel love. Your rabbi, I don't know whether he knows it himself, he is a courageous pioneer. I watch how it looks like. He performed an almost superhuman task in representing the Orthodox Jewish community vis-à-vis the outside world, I mean the Jewish outside world, the non-Orthodox, non-traditional community, as well as the Gentile world, with tact, dignity, and wisdom. And by so doing, he enhanced immensely our message. When I came to the United States so many years ago, Orthodoxy was at the low end. People, including Orthodox Jews themselves, laughed at Orthodoxy, treated the Orthodox rabbi, and then they called the so-called Orthodox Jew with disdain and contempt. As a matter of fact, 25, 30 years ago, we were not confronted by opponents and enemies, for we meant nothing. We could not arouse enmity. No one fought us. We simply did not exist. We met with laughter and ridicule, not with opposition. The situation is different now.
Why different?
And the change is due not to many, but a few people. Among whom Rabbi Lichtenstein is the most outstanding pioneer. He showed the American Jew, the assimilated Jew, the dissident Jew, that it is possible to have a synagogue architecturally as well as ritually conformed to the Shulchan Aruch. I must say, this type of rabbi reminds me of my youth, my childhood. I feel a kind of nostalgia. Conform to the Shulchan Aruch, and at the same time excel as far as good behavior, cultivated mannerism, beautiful sermon, officer. He, by example, or as well as by his speaking ability, contradicted the accusation hurled at us. And I heard this accusation many times, in my own shame, that orthodoxy is synonymous with slovenliness, vulgarity, ignorance, lack of culture, lack of refinement, and lack of artistic taste. I believe that we owe Rabbi Lichtenstein a yashkeach. He was not satisfied with the house of worship. He built the Ramah school. It's a pretty good school. Even some say, not two pints. In order to, what shall I say, to offer solace and comfort to Rabbi Lichtenstein, I can let him in on the secret. It is confidential. There they say the same thing about my mother's school, which I founded, it was. Organizing day school, a day school, and a good day school in New York 30 years ago was a heroic gesture. And I want to tell you, many children who would have never attended a yeshiva did come to Ramah school. And you know, I say here in Chumash every Saturday night, and a big crowd, young crowd, and many times a young boy, a young girl comes over to me after the shiur in the shiur and they ask me, where are you from? What's your background? Ramah. Boston, you know, in the center institution. He is a pioneer in the field of Jewish education. Thirdly, Rabbi Lichtenstein is fully responsible for the survival, growth, and development of the Bar Ilan University. One that would be very thankful. One may like Bar Ilan University, another one may dislike, may disagree. However, everyone must agree that no one else but Rabbi Lichtenstein could have accomplished the impossible. I believe that even for that he deserves a yashkeach. What else can I say? I can only pray that your illustrious rabbi should continue for many, many years to build, to quest for greater and greater things, to reach out for the impossible. But as far as Rabbi Lichtenstein is concerned, I don't know whether impossible is a proper word. Thank you.